Hello and welcome to the Westminster Skeptics podcast, brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist point of view. So if you enjoy Westminster Skeptics, you'll probably like our weekly podcast too. You can hear The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. But now, here's this month's Westminster Skeptics podcast, and for August 2012, the journalist Paul Lewis was invited to talk about his study on the riots, exactly a year after they happened. Here's Paul Lewis.
You know, last time I came here, it was a little under a year, because of course today's the year of the year anniversary of the day the riots began. But when I last came here to speak to you, I was extremely nervous. And maybe I didn't show it, but I was shaking inside, partly because Westminster Skeptics and skeptics generally, your kind of reputation precedes you. And I was warned that I would be taken apart, that people would listen politely and wait till questions and then just eat me alive. And the best thing I could do was really not really say anything. And so that was my strategy. I came to you, I talked to you a bit about what I'd seen, travelling around reporting the riots, and that bit was hard to disagree with because it was just my kind of witness account. And then what I did was come up with various hypotheses, things that people were talking about that they said to one degree or another explained the riots. And I told you why I thought those hypotheses didn't really make sense. And that's kind of a relatively easy thing to do because it's kind of, you know, proving a negative, if you like, or disproving a positive. But this time round, it's much harder, because this time round, I've been foolish enough to attempt some kind of evidence-based approach to work out what happened and why, and that's the plan today, to talk to you a bit about that. So one thing, though, very importantly, I think, David said that last time I was here, I said to you, you know, we were about to embark on this big research project. The truth is, when we did the talk here, we hadn't come up with the idea, and Westminster Skeptics was actually instrumental in convincing us that what we really needed was some kind of research with academic rigour. And it was after this meeting that I contacted Professor Tim Newburn at the London School of Economics, who runs the Social Policy Department, and said to him, look, do you want to do something about this? Do you want to attempt some kind of collaborative research project? So I'm going to talk to you about that. I'm going to talk to you about the project, which we called Reading the Riots, what we've learned, both about the riots themselves, and I think actually something quite interesting about journalism and social science as well. But I'm just going to start, I think might be useful to just recap exactly what happened a year ago and exactly what the riots were, because they were plural, and that's, I think, an important place to begin. You know, when you think about the riots and when people generally speak about them, I think they see them and conceive of them as a kind of single entity. But they were very, very different, both over time and in different places. So it began with, I guess, two bullets. We were initially told that at least one was shot by Mark Duggan, the other by police. In fact, both bullets came from a police gun. Mark Duggan was killed. And then 2 days later, there was a protest outside of the police station. And that's really not that uncommon. And the protest was actually more about the lack of answers and communication with the family than it was about the death itself. But of course, it was also about the unexplained killing of a man in Tottenham. And that model of a family and a community and friends gathering outside a police station is really one that you see repeated often when there are police killings of this kind. What was different is that it turned into violence. Initially it was only about 40 people. More people gathered. Police car was set on fire. Another police car was set on fire. A double-decker bus was set on fire. They were like magnets. So images started flying around, and you had people pouring into Tottenham Borough from other parts of London, particularly North and East London. And then that night, once Tottenham High Road was on fire and police were trying to control that area, the riots spread 2 miles west to Wood Green. And there it really wasn't rioting. It was more what you would call looting, I guess. There were no police there, and most of the high street was ransacked, and I was there to see that happening. It was very sad. And then the following day, the thing that really marked this out as a really significant bout of civil unrest, something that was going to spiral, was Enfield. And that was 6 miles north of Tottenham. At about 7 o'clock, 4 o'clock, it had been brewing for a couple of hours. Started with some smashing of police cars and breaking into shops. And then Enfield and Edmonton began rioting. And almost simultaneously, so did Brixton, after a carnival there spilled over into violence. And that was the second day. But most of the second day actually was looting rather than fighting with police. Most of what was happening was people running away from police, trying to escape them and breaking into shops. The third day was the most significant day imaginable. You had riots in 26 of London's 32 boroughs. Police have called the unrest on that third day unprecedented, and I think they're probably right. It's difficult to go back in history to find precedents, but certainly in modern history, really nothing quite like it. Croydon, Enfield, both North and South London, and then riots began to spread to Birmingham. By the fourth day, they'd stopped in London, but they'd by that point spread to Liverpool, Birmingham, Nottingham, Manchester and Salford. So really, you have to go back to the 1980s, the early 1980s, to come up with a comparison. And even then, you know, it took place over several months, the riots of 1981 and then latterly of 86. Several months. What we had last year was 4 days. So much more intense, arguably more ferocious, and different. Definitely different to the type of rioting that we'd experienced in the past. So to tell you a bit about where we were about 11 months ago, we were considering running this project. We had had that really quite remarkable bout of civil disorder, and the government were refusing to open a formal public inquiry. So there was going to be no Scarman-esque inquiry. After some political to-ing and fro-ing, they agreed to launch this thing called the Victims and Communities Panel that would go around communities and listen to people and hear their side of things. But no kind of rigorous attempt to try to find out exactly why the riots had happened. And in that vacuum, I think David was right, that actually people saw in the riots what they wanted to see. It was a confirmation of political views. And, you know, for the right wing, from the extreme, almost maniacal right of Starkey and the whites becoming black, to the left, who would argue that the riots were not riots but a protest, not against the austerity cuts, because they hadn't quite bitten at that point, but the impending austerity cuts. And in between, all sorts of other theories. Now, David Lammy saying that parents should be able to smack their children more, and that was partly an explanation for why 15,000 people came out and caused absolute havoc. To, you know, some issue to do with a moral compass, that somehow we had absorbed the moral failures of bankers and MPs who'd fiddled their expenses. But none of it really seemed that plausible. And all of it was based upon supposition, really. There was no evidence at that point. Nobody had done, I think, I would argue, the crucial thing of going out and speaking to the people who had been directly involved. So it was actually one of the community's patrons. Is James Ball a patron, David? Not quite. When he gets older. Many of you will know James Ball. He's currently at the Washington Post, colleague of mine from The Guardian, who spotted a blog. And the blog linked to a study in Detroit, which had been conducted 40 years earlier, to the 1967 Detroit riots, which were the deadliest riots in modern US history. And it was a study between a newspaper and a university. And 2 days after we had what I thought was a really enjoyable discussion in this pub, I phoned up a guy called Professor Phil Mayer, who's still knocking around, but he was the professor who basically ran that study into the Detroit riots. And I said, now, how did you do it? And do you think we could do it again to study the England riots of 2011? And he said, you really need two things, practically speaking. You need a really good academic partner, a partner that's got kind of credibility and you can work with, and you need funding, because it's going to be expensive. And journalists don't really have very much money. neither did the news organisations they work for. So we knew that that was going to be an issue. But the first thing we did was get Tim Newbern on board. I actually just Googled at the beginning, academics, riots, criminology. And then Tim came at the top. He didn't come at the top, but he came up in the top 10. And I phoned up lots of people and just got on with Tim. And he could see this was a really exciting prospect, proposition. And then once I had Tim on board, we drew up a kind of proposal and sent it to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and Open Society Foundations, and they gave us the money to run this research study. So then we went away, and I'm going to tell you briefly about the kind of methodology, because I know that's going to be what excites people to some degree. Probably because you'll profoundly disagree with it. But anyway, this is what we did. We split the project into two halves, so phase one and phase two. The first phase, we thought the most important thing to do, the thing that was lacking, because you'd heard lots of voices from police and victims and politicians, was to speak to the people who were directly involved in the riots. And that's what they did in Detroit. It would make a lot of sense to do it here first. So we wanted to do that. We also wanted to study social media because it was a really interesting component of what had happened. So Twitter, the company, were very kind, and they gave us this database of more than 2.6 million riot-related tweets, just on a little memory stick. So we had that. And then the second phase, we were always going to interview police, victims, so-called, for want of a better phrase, vigilantes, but people who came out onto their streets to defend their neighborhoods. So we made that division, and then we tried to think about the best methodology that would be used. And really, I mean, Tim's done all sorts, but his main thing, I guess, is a qualitative approach. And I think if you look at the way most riots have been studied in history, in fact, the way other people who also attempted to, in a smaller scale, to study the riots last year did it, they all adopted principally qualitative approaches. So it was interview large numbers of people, not huge numbers, these weren't polls, but large numbers of people, in-depth interviews, attempt to have a kind of a neutral, non-leading interviewing approach, in which the rioters or the respondents, to use a better phrase, would lead the interview and tell us whatever they wanted about their experiences. And we would occasionally nudge them here and there to try to get them to talk about the things that we wanted to hear about, but not put words into their mouths. And then we took those interviews, and this is the same approach that we used for everybody we interviewed, and we transcribed them, and we put them into a database, and then we had a team of LSE analysts who went through these interviews and coded them. They essentially kind of themed these interviews. They would take extracts and quotes, and it's a kind of layering process. It's kind of, I guess, almost like peeling an onion. You go over the same interview time and time and time again, and you pull out things which you think are significant and correlate with what other interviewees have said, and then you have a central kind of database, a themed database, and this builds and builds and builds and builds, and the more times you do it, the more nuanced and the more detailed and the more insightful that central database becomes, because for every theme that we had more and more people talking about it. So give us some understanding. It wasn't, as we said before, a poll. It wasn't quantifiable. It wasn't the type of theory that you could, or finding that you could easily test. But it was the approach that we thought would best fit the challenge that we had. Don't forget, we didn't know who the rioters were. If you say, what's your control group? Well, who are the rioters? We didn't know until we began speaking to them. So that was the approach. And then, more importantly for today, what did we find? Well, let me begin with who were the rioters. They were very different in different places, as you can imagine. Mainly young. And I think, I mean, much of this you might think, well, we knew that at the beginning. And I'm sorry if it's boring, but at least now we have evidence to prove it. So they were mainly young, and of those we interviewed, 3/4 under the age of 24. You've got two basically quite good but very different sources for a lot of this information. One is our interviews, and we interviewed 270 rioters. The other is the data that the Ministry of Justice has released on arrestees, or even better, people who've been convicted. And they tend to tally. So there's not that much difference between what those stats say, and that's one particular type of population, people who are arrested in connection to the riots, and what our information shows. So almost half were students, which I thought was particularly interesting. Those who were not in education and of working age, 60% were unemployed. Racially, it tended to, and I've read a lot about this, which is highly misleading, about the kind of racial makeup of the rioters. Around half were black or Asian, mainly black, but that tended to differ a lot by geography. So in Salford, they were obviously predominantly white, in Tottenham, predominantly black, but it tended to reflect the area that the rioters were coming from. And if you wanted a kind of single demographic thread, other than, say, age and gender, there were many men, I should say, although, again, there's some difference between the arrestee data and our data as to gender. If you look at the arrestee data, it's about 10% men. If you look at ours, sorry, 10% women. If you look at ours, more like 20% women involved. But anyway, the single demographic thread other than gender and, I guess, age, because they were mainly young, was poverty. So, according to the arrestee data, 50% who appeared in court were from the most deprived 20% of areas. Our data, 70% the most deprived 30 boroughs. But also things like free school meals, special educational needs, a lot of the kind of obvious indicators would suggest that they were predominantly people who were either poor or from poor areas. So what did they say? And I think this is important. What did they say as opposed to what do we say? Because one of the things that I think we were criticized for, and I'll talk a bit about this in a minute, is I think people misrepresented what we were trying to say when we launched our first findings. People preferred to suggest that we were claiming the riots were caused by X or Y or Z factor, when we were simply relaying what rioters had told us. And I think there's an important distinction there. And when I say, what do they say? Well, to who? I should have said this at the beginning. Who were our interviewers? They were a really interesting mixed bunch of people. The first thing we did when we launched the project was put an advert on the website. I know what some of you are going to say now, but anyway. We put an advert on the website and we said, would you like to apply to be a researcher for our project? And we had 450 people apply from across the country. We interviewed 60 of them and we chose 30. So these were the 30 people who were going to go out into the country, find people involved in the riots, persuade them to talk anonymously, and interview them. And what we were looking for were people with two things, really. One was a good connection with the communities that were affected by the riots. And secondly, people who had exhibited to us that they'd had a past in interviewing, that they had skills in interviewing, and they could do kind of non-leading neutral interviews. So those were the people who went out, tried to find people. We gave them some assistance, some training, and conducted these interviews. And they weren't all perfect. There was quite a significant variation in the standard of interviewing, but most of them were pretty good. So what did the rioters say to us about why they got involved? And that's, I guess, the key thing to kind of convey to you today. And I would really split it into three categories. And this is, of course, a simplification. It necessarily has to be. But three broad categories. And this is what we said, incidentally, when we launched the first tranche of findings, phase one, in December. So the first thing I'd say is they were very candid about opportunism. So they said to us, one of the reasons we got involved was because we saw this as a chance to acquire free stuff. This was an opportunity where law was suspended. You could essentially do what you want with impunity, and we wanted to kind of exploit that to get some stuff, to get a stereo, to get some trainers. It was irresistible. So they seized the opportunity. And many of them, I think, were very candid with us about that being one of the driving factors for them getting involved. The second thing, it might prove more controversial, although I don't think it should do. Many people spoke about perceived inequalities or perceived injustices. And they might be present in many different kind of forms. So it could be economic. It could be people saying, we don't have the opportunity to get rich like other people do. It could be more social. I mean, lots of people said that they didn't feel they had the opportunities for jobs. If they applied for a job, they were far less likely to get it than somebody else. You know, it could be something as kind of vague and inchoate as a simple description of kind of us and them. And it often was. You know, many of the people we spoke to wouldn't, for example, know who was in government, but they would be angry at government. They wouldn't really know the way in which the country was run. I'm not speaking for all of them, but many of them. But they would use symbols, like the Queen was one of the more frequent ones, to describe their antipathy, their anger, their sense that something wasn't right, and they were angry. So race was a really difficult thing for us to get our heads around, because it both is a factor and isn't at the same time. One of the things that people were very adamant about was that these were not race riots, and any attempt to suggest that the riots had something to do with race were very quickly knocked back. That said, they did often express having experienced some of these inequalities in racial terms. So they would say, the reason I'm in this position in society, the reason I'm fed up and angry, the reason the government doesn't treat me right or people like me right is because of the color of my skin. But these riots have nothing to do with race, if that makes sense. That's what we were told. And another area, and this probably proved most controversial, but as time goes on, I become more and more sure that we were completely right to say it. But another area in which people experienced these perceived injustices was around police and police relations. So, to sum it up, I guess, a significant factor in the riots, a significant driver for why people came out onto the streets, particularly in some areas, not all, and more so in some areas than others, was a sense of frustration with their day-to-day experiences and interactions with police. That on the ground, in many of the communities that had rioted, there was a mutual distrust between certain sectors of the community and police, sometimes almost a kind of mutual loathing, a hatred. Many people felt they weren't spoken to with respect, weren't treated with respect, and they saw this as their opportunity, as they put it, for revenge or for retribution. They wanted to get the police back. And when they heard there were riots and there was stuff going on, they went out to join in. And if that seems doubtful to you, I would say just look at what happened in some places. Just look at what happened in Hackney. Just look at what happened in Handsworth in Birmingham, where pretty much the whole community took over large areas. The police station, much of this wasn't reported, was ransacked, set on fire, people running around the streets wearing police uniforms, hurling police helmets at cars. Just astonishing. Look at what happened in Salford and Toxteth. And in these places, yeah? My passion. Okay, well, if you just hold on 1 second, we've got questions after. Okay, so if you look at places like Salford and Hackney and Toxteth and speak to the people who were involved, and both their accounts of why they did it and what they did, it was frustration and hatred toward police. Justified or not, that's what they felt. Okay, and then finally, oh, sorry, one significant aspect of this, because it's been discussed a lot. Within our findings, one of the things that we said, that one of the issues, I guess one of the fault lines around which this frustration and this mutual animosity was exhibited was around stop and search. Many people disputed this, but this is what we were told. And 73% of the people we interviewed, don't forget they're all ages from 13 to 57, 73% had been stopped and searched in the last year, and that made them 8 times more likely to have been stopped and searched than the wider general population. So for many of them, it wasn't just the fact that they were far more likely to be stopped and searched than other people. It wasn't just the fact that the way in which the stop and search happened frustrated them. They thought it wasn't done with respect. They thought they were being mistreated. They thought there was an abuse of power that was going on. For many of them, it was just the intensity. It was, as I remember very vividly in one transcript I read, somebody saying, imagine if every time you left your house to go to see your friend, you knew you would be stopped and searched. And if it happens the first time, and then you're out with your friends and it happens again, and by the time you're coming home at 1 o'clock in the morning, it happens a third time, it really, really gets to you. So that was another aspect that we drew out from the research. And then the third thing, if you remember, the first was opportunism, the second perceived inequalities of different types. The third was something that I felt, actually, and from having interviewed 130 police officers, we know the police felt too, which was just the excitement, the thrill, the exhilaration, the kind of intoxicating feeling that you get when you are in the midst of a riot. And one of the things that I think is really hard to convey with words is the difference between what riots look like on a television screen and what they feel like when you're there. Because, you know, it is violent destruction, it's mindless, and it certainly looks like it's just people on the absolute fringes of society taking part. But at the same time, it is, for those who are involved, fun. Something that everybody they know, or most of their friends, are doing at the same time. And they enjoyed it. And they wanted to do it again after they'd done it the first time. Most of the people we spoke to didn't just go out one night, have a look and come back. They went out again. If you look at where people, look at people where people rioted, and then you compare that to their address, people were traveling all over the place. I mean, we spoke to people who'd actually started in one part of London on the first night, travelled to Tottenham, the second night went to Hackney, by the third night were in Croydon, by the fourth night they were in Birmingham. So all over the place. They wanted more of it, and it was exciting. So that's what they said to us as their kind of explanations for why they got involved, many of them. And I know that the policing aspect of it proved to be the most controversial. It's also, interestingly, one of the areas where there's, strangely, you might not think this, but a broad degree of agreement among those who have actually conducted research into the riots. So the others who conducted research into the riots include NatSen, which is a social science research organization, and they did a kind of quite quiet study on behalf of the Cabinet Office. Similar methodological approach, broadly similar findings, including on that issue of policing and stop and search. And the same for the Victims and Communities Panel. They interviewed a small number of people involved in the riots, a much larger number of communities affected in the riots, but came to similar conclusions. So why did the riots spread? And that's a really interesting question, especially when you think about the speed with which they spread. And I think for this section of the talk, I just want to kind of compare what was said in the weeks after the riots, when I was here talking with you all last time, and what we now know. And I think this gets more interesting. So let's begin with gangs. So gangs, David Cameron, gangs were at the heart of the riots and were behind the coordinated attacks. If you want one single policy area that the government has focused on since the riots, it's gangs. The very small amount of new money that's been made available for some kind of policy initiative has been all around gangs, Theresa May and gangs. You'll remember Bill Bratton, a gang czar or police czar from the United States, who was brought over to teach us how to better deal with gangs. And Metropolitan Police, immediately after the riots, said that 28%, that's over a quarter, of those involved were members of gangs. And then they subsequently revised that to 19%, and then subsequently revised that to 13%, and then they revised it again, and they said they didn't know how many were involved. The truth is, of course, and what's a member of a gang for a start? I mean, you don't have a badge. But this was based on police intelligence. But it's true. People who were associated with criminal gangs were there. But it's not true that they were the driving force for what was happening and that they were organising the systematic looting that was going on. On the fringes, absolutely, there were occasions where that was happening. And there was, you know, in places, some quite obvious attempts to exploit the mayhem, targeting warehouses right on the outskirts of London, for example, the Sony Centre, And the way in which that was done, it was very clearly that they were kind of quite serious criminals who were doing it. But in the large part, the people we spoke to across England, when we asked them about gangs, they said one thing, and they all agreed on this, and it's very interesting. Gangs were there, some gang members were there, but they were behaving in a completely counterintuitive way. So basically, there was a truce. The hostilities that you would often get between gangs that would have stopped, for example, in London, people from Edmonton travelling to Tottenham or Enfield were suspended. And those kind of hostilities and those gang boundaries dissipated for 4 days. And everybody said the same, and they couldn't believe it was happening. I mean, many of them were just astonished that gang leaders, who they thought they would never see standing near each other if they weren't fighting, were helping each other out. And there was actually, strangely enough, a residue from all of this, a kind of 2 or 3 week legacy in which people said they saw people from rival gangs at parties a couple of weeks afterwards. So it had some kind of lasting impact. But anyway, gangs were there. Gang members were there, as you can imagine. But people, the way they moved, the way they were hanging out, the way the riots were unfolding, we were told did not have very much to do with gangs because they were behaving in a way that wouldn't have been expected. Social media. And this is the really interesting one as well, because I remember this was a kind of a big area of discussion last time. The extent to which the riots were driven by this new ferocious monster of a viral technology, either called Twitter or Facebook. And again, look back to 11 months ago and what the government was saying. Go back to David Cameron, emergency session of Parliament. He says of Facebook and Twitter, everyone watching these horrific actions will be struck by how they were organized via social media. We are working with the police, the intelligence services, and industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder, and criminality. And he was backed up by the then acting Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, who said he'd actually consulted with lawyers to see whether or not there is a way that they could stop UK users from accessing Twitter during the riots. So, no, there isn't. But so convinced were they that actually the social media had, to some, you know, had in a significant way been used to organise and incite and share information about the riots whilst they were happening. And actually, I think many of us probably thought that too. And I think probably one of the reasons we thought that is because fools like me were running around tweeting our way through the riots, and many of us understood the riots through a lens of social media. And it's just an association, probably. You know, the riots felt like they had so much to do with Twitter because we were viewing them through a lens of Twitter. And the truth is, when we spoke to these people who were involved and responsible for the rioting and looting, they used neither Facebook nor Twitter. I mean, that's a generalization, but we found nobody who used either to incite or to organize. Yes, they came across information. Yes, people were posting stuff saying, have you seen what's going on in my town centre? But in terms of the specifics, the meet at this place at this time, it was very rare, which makes it so strange that the severest penalties were given, some of the most severe penalties were given to people convicted for inciting riots over Facebook, upheld, incidentally, at the Court of Appeal. But anyway, the people we spoke to, it wasn't Facebook or Twitter, and actually they said, why would it be? These are public forums. It's like going into a community hall and saying, does anyone want to come outside right now and join me in a riot? A community hall where there's all sorts of nice people, including nice police officers. You wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. And they didn't do it. What they did do, and of course lots of people know about this now, but probably we didn't know the extent to which it was important, was they used BlackBerry Messenger. And BlackBerry Messenger, for those who don't know, it's a similar network to Twitter in the sense that you've got groups of friends, so it's a kind of network, but it's different in some quite significant ways. The most significant thing of all is that it's a closed technology and it's encrypted. So they know that police can't see what you're talking about, and it's not public, and you can share private information. And lots of teenagers at the time, I don't know whether it's still the case, had BlackBerry phones. They're the cheapest handset for £5 a month. You have got unlimited BBM messaging. cheapest kind of smartphone you can buy if you want a smartphone. If you want a normal phone, then of course you can get cheaper. But that's kind of some of the reasons why lots of teenagers had BlackBerries. They were already conversing on BBM technology, and they were using it again and again and again to advertise where they should meet, at what time, at what location. And they were essentially flash mobs. And if someone writes a PhD thesis saying these were the flash mob riots, it might sound silly, but they were probably going to be right. Because if you look at the way the crowd suddenly just appeared in different places, completely unannounced, seemingly inexplicable for those who were there, myself included, police as well, it just didn't make sense. You know, at a certain time, maybe just before 5 o'clock, just before 6 o'clock, you saw a whole group of people just converge, and then they would start smashing shops or attacking police. And I've got one such example here of a BBM message. And I've got it actually not from the research that we did, but we had this BBM message during the riots. One of the things that we did when we got wind of the fact that there was this technology that we journalists just didn't know about that was being used was run out quickly, buy a BlackBerry and set ourselves up on BBM and start tweeting and saying, has anyone got any BBM messages? And this is one of the ones that came through on Sunday morning, the day that there were riots in Enfield. It came through about midday. And it said, and lots of people got this message, it said, everyone in Edmonton, Enfield, Wood Green, everywhere in North London, link up at Enfield Town Station at 4 o'clock sharp. You can tell where I was at 4 o'clock sharp. Start leaving your yards and linking up with your niggers. Fuck the feds. Bring your ballies and your bags, trolleys, balaclavas, cars, vans, hammers, the lot. Keep sending this round to Bear Man. Make sure no snitch boys get this. There's journalists like me. Whatever ends you're from, put your ballies on, link up and cause havoc, just rob everything. Police can't stop it. Dead the fires, though. I think that last line is in some ways most interesting. Dead the fires, though. So you can do all of this. You can kill police officers. You can bring hammers. You can smash your way into shops, but no fires. And actually, it's interesting because when we interviewed people, those that felt remorse, and there were quite a few of them that did, often spoke about the fires. It was as though that was a kind of boundary that they shouldn't have been crossed. Okay, so I'm just going to finish now on talking about the last couple of things very quickly. One of them, policing, because the second phase, as I told you, we interviewed large numbers of police officers, 130 in total, and it was quite strange for our researchers. I mean, I know some of you after the break are going to start talking to me about research bias and, you know, these researchers and what kind of prejudices they had when they came to the project. But I do think that they probably, if I'm being honest, developed prejudices through having interviewed many of these rioters, and it would be probably inhuman if they didn't. They heard their stories, they heard their arguments, they realized that they were people not that dissimilar to them and their brothers and sisters, and maybe they developed a certain kind of degree of sympathy for them. And actually, maybe when they heard them talking about the riots and talking about their animosity toward police, they developed similar prejudices about police. But those went the moment they spoke to the police officers. You know, I saw the researchers coming back, and they were really quite moved by the bravery and the courage and the heroism and the decency, the thorough decency, actually, of many police officers who were on the front line. You know, one thing that senior police will tell you about the riots, and I think rightly so, is that they are astonished they didn't lose anyone. It's one of the most remarkable things about the riots last year is that no police officers died. And I think one of the reasons no police officers died is actually they adopted the right tactics, and their tactics were widely misunderstood. It may have looked on the television like police officers standing back, and often they were standing back. There was a shop being looted, and they would let people smash it and break into it and throw bricks. I'll tell you. So I'm happy. Okay. Don't push him out. Until he started talking about the homeless people, I thought he might be a police officer. We're right next to New Scotland Yard. I was like, oh, God. Okay, I'm quite happy for questions, but so long as they come afterwards. Anyhow, it looked like police were standing back. They were standing back, and I think it's very difficult for them. Many of them wanted to get stuck in, to be honest. But the reason they were standing back is because it was their standard tactic. It was protect life first and foremost. And if people are smashing into a shop, you're not protecting life if you go in and arrest them. Then second to life to protect property, and this is what police will tell you. And then thirdly, if you've got a limited amount of resources, and that's why they thought they lost control, because they didn't have enough police officers, then the last thing you want to do is make arrests. Because if you make arrests, that's two people from your line that need to go back to the station, the arresting officer and another witness. So they left it, and they left it to CCTV. And I think they were probably right. 4,000 arrests, the vast majority of them based on CCTV evidence gathered after the fact. So I think they adopted the right strategy, but there was one real significant failing. And again, this may seem obvious to you, but you really realise it when you interview the police officers. And that was an absolutely catastrophic failure in mobilising resources. So on day one of the riots, there were maybe 200 or 300 police officers who went to the scene quick enough. Nowhere near enough. By day two, again, they didn't mobilise enough officers. By day three, you would expect they would be ready. But it wasn't until the fourth day, when the riots had finished, that the Met brought in large numbers of officers from forces around the capital. It's a system of mutual aid. It's a kind of alarm system linked to COBRA that you use in times of civil emergency. And whether it was through arrogance or through a mistake or whatever, the Met didn't instigate that alarm quick enough. They didn't have enough police officers in the capital quick enough. And you can make different arguments. You know, you can say, well, why did the riots finish on the fourth day? Was it because there were such large numbers of police? Or was that just a coincidence? Either way, it doesn't matter. They should have had the officers there quicker, and they kind of recognised that fact. I'm going to finish very quickly, because I'm approaching the 45-minute mark. Or am I not? Okay. So I'm going to finish anyhow, and I'm going to finish by just talking to you about a couple of things that I think we have learned about the riots, and then we can debate it afterwards and tell me why we're wrong. But actually, more than what we learned about the riots, two things that I think we learned through doing this project. Okay, so one of them is journalists make the worst interviewers. We really are bad. I don't think lawyers are bad as journalists. I really don't. So journalists, some of you may be journalists here, and you probably won't like me saying this, but the way journalists interview people, well, we haven't got very long for a start. So we get them on the phone, and we have a pre-existing idea of what we want them to say. And we probably know where in the article we're going to fit their quote, okay? And we probably know what that quote's going to be. So when we ask them, we cut straight to the point. We say, what do you think about this? Do you think it's like this? Is that what, is what you mean? And then we basically put words into their mouth. And then if they don't say exactly what we wanted them to say, bugger it, we'll just say they said that anyway, okay? So it's an attempt at turning what should be concrete words into plasticine and leading people to the place where you want them to be. And whilst it might work for a journalist on deadline, it really doesn't tell you what somebody really thinks about something. And it was a massive eye-opener to see this new interviewing strategy that was new, as in not new, we didn't invent it, but it was new for those of us who came from a journalistic tradition, working. So, you know, an approach whereby you let somebody tell you what they think first of all, you let them dictate the speed of the interview, where the interview goes, and every time you try to direct the interview, you do it in a non-leading way. So you say something like, can you tell me a bit more about that? Or in what way did that happen? Or what happened after that? And really quite simple, neutral questions. And it was just astounding what people managed to get out of these interviews through this kind of non-leading approach. So that was the first thing that I've learned, and I think it's probably changed the way I approach my job. The second thing is, well, I mean, it's not about journalism or social science, but it's just about whenever you do a project of this kind, it tells you something about the media, because journalists normally were used to reporting about other people's research projects. And again, I'm slightly kind of simplifying here, but, you know, we take at somebody's project, they've worked on it for 2 or 3 years, a really important piece of research, and, you know, we take what we think is significant about it. You know, have a look at the executive summary, go through a few pages, look at the footnotes, take out a fact a finding that we think might be significant, or maybe we turn it into a finding that we think would be significant and make that the headline. And it really frustrates academics. And one of the things that Tim was really excited about this project was the idea that, you know, he wouldn't have to rely upon journalists interpreting the research because they would be, you know, co-running the research. And he could, in return, co-write the headlines and co-write the copy, which is what he did. And all our partners at the LSE did that with us. But what was really eye-opening for me was, you know, we could write our own headlines and we could write our own interpretations, but we had no control over what other news organizations would do. And the way in which people took what we said, twisted it, contorted it, created straw mans which they could then take apart, was a really strange experience, actually. And it made me realize that as hard as you try, there's only going to be a limit to what you can do in terms of the kind of impact of research of this kind. I mean, yes, important people can read it. Yes, important people will listen to what you have to say, and you'll have, to some degree, some kind of an impact. But I realized that the research that we put in, all of the hours work that we put in, all the money that went into the project, is for many people just reduced down to one finding. You know, the riots are about stop and search. And that's not what we said, that's not what we found. And I hope, at the very least, that you will leave this discussion thinking that we found a little more than that, at least.
Paul Lewis.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, or from a sceptical rationalist point of view. You can download our weekly podcast at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.